Hello and welcome to 120 Common Threads of Kentucky History. I'm your host, Alan Lytle, News Director of 91.3 WUKY in Lexington, and my partners in crime are Stuart Sanders and Gregory Hardison of the Kentucky Historical Society. Hello again, gentlemen.
Hey, Alan, how are you?
How you doing,
well.
Alan?
I'm doing great. It's 5 o'clock somewhere, and that's a little hint as to what we're going to be tackling as far as the subject is concerned. But first of all, for the folks that maybe didn't hear our first podcast, our first venture, which was on the Kentucky Derby and one of Kentucky's signature industries, thoroughbred racing, let's first explain the whole rationale of 120 Common Threads of Kentucky History.
Well, Alan, we've got 120 counties, and every county has its own distinct history. And so what we're hoping to do is, use this framework to explore just the wonders of Kentucky's past and really figure out how does our past really relate to problems that we face today. And I think we're starting to do that with our 120 Kentucky podcast.
Yeah, and that was Stuart, and now we're going to hear from Greg.
I have nothing to say. You can't say it any better than that. That's a really good description of what our goals are. But I think the key here is the partnership between the Kentucky Historical Society and the WUKY. We're pulling from our past archives and the work that we do, but we both, serve a public. And, being able to combine what's in the news with the historical relevance of the past is, I think, a key component here.
Yeah, and as mentioned, the first one was on the thoroughbred industry in Kentucky. Well, guess what? We have another signature industry that we're talking about today, and I said it's 5 o'clock somewhere. That should give you the biggest hint. Bourbon. Bourbon is in the spotlight today.
Bourbon.
Yes, indeed.
Thank you, Homer.
So we've got an awful lot of information, some interviews, and some stuff from the Kentucky Historical Society archives. We tell people to just sort of open up their favorite bottle of Pappy if they want. And we have an action-packed program for your listening pleasure today, covering just about all aspects of the bourbon industry. And we start with an article from the Kentucky Historical Society's archives. You're going to hear a little bit about that. Stuart, you interviewed Adam Johnson with the Kentucky Bourbon Trail.
Yeah, and Adam's a great person to talk to. He knows everything bourbon. And, we talked about how do distilleries use history? How is it integral to what they're doing in terms of promoting their products in the Bourbon Trail? And, one interesting thing is he talked about how are they, depicting race and diversity on the Bourbon Trail, and how are they researching sort of underrepresented voices? And that's something that came through in a lot of the segments that we talked about today. I couldn't pin him down on his favorite bourbon brand, which I've been trying to do for at least 10 years. But, it was a fun conversation. Even included, what will future historians study about the bourbon industry today? So, really insightful thought about tourism and the future of bourbon.
And yours truly got a chance to go to the distillery in Frankfurt that you're talking about, Buffalo Trace. I mean, because I had to be on the spot to sort of, do some research of my own. And I got a chance to talk to a bourbon archaeologist, and I'm going to introduce you today to the unofficial mayor of Buffalo Trace Distillery. We get to hear that segment, which I'm really excited about.
Everybody loves Freddie.
Right. Now, yeah. With your conversation with Nick, too, the bourbon archaeologist, I really loved how he stressed authenticity and, places like the Jewett House, which is a great, Woodford County historic site. And, that's sort of another theme, another common thread that runs through this episode is, authenticity in that history and that heritage of the entire bourbon industry.
Yeah, and now, and we're also talking about what makes a great bourbon and maybe arguably the oldest bourbon recipe in existence. And, Greg has a great segment on that as well.
Yeah, I spoke with Sherry Daniels and Dina Thomas, who have done extensive research on this 1918 recipe of sweet mash. We hear about sour mash whiskey perhaps a lot more often than we do about sweet mash, but these are two old recipes from May 18th, 1818. But there's some controversy about whether it was actually written by the person that our records say it was. So we'll dig into that.
I also love how that story, Greg, really talks about the enslaved workers who also may have been involved in creating that mash. So
it
again,
does.
It's another thread that we've got in this episode.
Yeah, it connects right back to Casey County there and your interview with Adam.
Yeah, and we wrap it all up, of course, bellying up to the bar with the perfect mint julep.
Guys, wait until you hear this recipe. It is how to make a mint julep, but in the most flowery language you can imagine.
I'm going to be excited to hear that. It's all around the corner. Thanks for tuning in for 120 Common Threads of Kentucky History. Let's get started.
Yeah, so I can start from our archives. Well, it's a publication from Kentucky itself. It's called In Kentucky. And I'm making a connection slightly back to our very first podcast where we also read an article from that publication for our Derby episode. But this one also takes place during World War II, but it is how the bourbon industry was affected by World War II. And so take a listen to this article from the autumn 1942 edition. It was 25 cents is how much this thing cost for this little publication. Here it is.
Kentucky is rightfully proud of the part its distillers are playing in the national war effort. Alcohol is a strategic war material. It is used, among other things, as a base for smokeless powder, plastics for airplanes, and synthetic rubber. Even before Pearl Harbor put us definitely into the shooting war, it was clear to Kentucky distillers that commercial industrial alcohol plants would be unable to meet the demands made on them for the production of 190-proof alcohol. Kentucky distillers offered their services to the government as far back as October 1940 and have since been playing an increasingly important part in the country's war effort. All Kentucky distilleries capable of making 190-proof alcohol have been producing nothing else since shortly after Pearl Harbor. Other distilleries have been shipping high wines to commercial alcohol plants unable to get molasses. These high wine distilleries are now in the process of being converted, without the use of critical war materials, into plants that can and will make 190-proof alcohol. Chemists for Kentucky distilleries have devised ways of converting molasses using commercial alcohol plants into grain-using plants. At their own expense, they have made blueprints for such changes, supervised installation of equipment, and have been available for consultation as to its operations. They have done the same for brandy and rum distilleries. They have shown how wheat, as well as corn and rye, can be used. They have devised a new continuous fermentation process, which in 4 or 5 hours now does work which formerly required 4 or 5 days. One fermenter now can do the work formerly done by 10. If there is plenty of industrial alcohol for smokeless powder, for plastics, and for synthetic rubber, Kentucky distillers are due a major share of the credit. Kentucky distillers are not only producing alcohol for war work and showing others how to do the same thing, but are using surplus grain on which governmental agencies had lent millions of dollars. Because of the expert knowledge of Kentucky distillers, the American farmer will be better off not only in the immediate future, but also after the end of the war, when grain can still be used. The foregoing, of course, are merely the high spots of a vast patriotic program. Employees of Kentucky distilleries are serving in the Army, the Navy, and the Marine Corps. They also are serving in many vital governmental bureaus, buying their full share of war bonds, and paying as an industry a greater amount of taxes and a greater proportion of their income than our workers of any other industry.
Well, very fascinating to hear where bourbon has been, and right now we're going to turn to where bourbon is going.
Well, I had a wonderful conversation with Adam Johnson, who's the senior director of the Kentucky Bourbon Trail. And we talked about how do distilleries use history and how is it integral to their message. And one really interesting thing that Adam touches on in this interview is how race and diversity is depicted on the Bourbon Trail and how are distilleries sort of looking at their past to focus on those issues. So I really enjoyed talking to him. I unfortunately could not pin him down on his favorite bourbon, but we did have a great conversation about what future historians will study about bourbon today, whether it's the international impact of bourbon and the cyclical nature of the industry. So it was fun to talk to him and kind of get a sense of where bourbon tourism is today. I'm speaking with Adam Johnson, who's the senior director of the Kentucky Bourbon Trail, which is managed by the Kentucky Distillers Association. And Adam, thanks so much for joining me.
Hey, thanks for having me on. It's good to have some time with a good Center College graduate, and they found nobody better than you. I mean, you've got the radio voice, dude.
Well, thanks. I've heard that before. You know, I have a face for radio is probably the best way to put it. Well, first, can you, you know, tell us a little bit about the Kentucky Bourbon Trail?
Absolutely. It's a little bit different these days, as I think everyone can imagine with the pandemic going on. But celebrating our 21st birthday this year, sadly, most of it's gone virtual. I mean, yes, we're still having guests in, but not nearly the numbers that we're used to having here in Kentucky, but really just designed to showcase what makes Kentucky bourbon, in our eyes, the best bourbon. It's all the brands you know, some of the brands you might not know, and that's a big part of the Kentucky Bourbon Trail is that exploration. Most people that come in, they may know their favorite brand, and they visit that distillery and then get to hit up a couple more and get some new friends and brands that they love. So I always say I have the best job in the Commonwealth of getting people to learn and love and know more about Kentucky bourbon.
Now, how many sites are on the trail right now?
Well, we've got 18 on the Kentucky Bourbon Trail, and the sister trail, Kentucky Bourbon Trail Craft Tour, we have 19 on.
So how do you see these distilleries on the trail using history as a way to promote their products and their sites?
I would say it's integral. You go to these more of these long-standing brands that you know, so many of them date back just decades. And that brand history is part of their story. I mean, you can just think of so many of these guys, whether it's Old Forester being the first bottled bourbon, or you know, when Jim Beam started right after, bringing back the distillery right after Prohibition, to just name it. I mean, so many of our guys have so much history going back. And I think that brand story and brand evolution is a big part of the tours. It's a lot of the kind of tradition and history that makes Kentucky bourbon that's infused with so much pride. I think, as you said, so many Kentuckians take bourbon so seriously. And I think it just goes back to that history and tradition with the brands, with the process. I know on our site, kybourbon.com, we have a little bit of a history timeline on there. Just around the way in Casey County is the first recorded note that we found of a family using the sour mash process. So as much as history can kind of inform the modern process of making Kentucky bourbon to, you know, the 18, 1700s, then you've got people like Wilderness Trail or other brands that are using the sweet mash process, using a little bit more of that scientific approach, you know, using what they've learned in the past to maybe tweak things around and do things a little bit differently. So history is just a big part of it. It's a part of the brands, but it's also part of how some of the of our newer brands are taking different approaches based on that history, if that makes sense. So I think all our visitors come in knowing they're going to get a good history lesson as part of their tour.
Well, and you think about all the famous brands that are actually named after historic distillers too. You know, you have numerous award-winning brands who really tie their products to that history based on the person who initially made the bourbon.
For sure. There's a million of these guys that are so infused with that old name. And if I said Jim Beam earlier, they brought back Old Tub recently, which is a great bourbon that's really resurrecting that old brand before Jim Beam's name kind of got on the bottle.
Oh, wow.
Old Forster's doing that with their series based on the key years and their history at Brown-Forman. You know, 1920, I think, is the one that people really know and love. But there's I think, four in the series that really honor the different key years, like 1870, when that first bottled bourbon kind of came out for Old Forester. So, yeah, you're right. There's so many names on those bottles that go back. And so I'm just really curious to see over time with some of our newer brands, you know, when do those get kind of carved in those the echelon of those old names? It's just kind of fun to see that timeline stretch a little bit.
You know, we have bourbon distilleries who are using history to promote their products. How does the Kentucky Distillers Association and the Kentucky Bourbon Trail specifically, how do you all use history as a way to promote the Kentucky Bourbon Trail?
Well, I think we talk about the history of our association a little bit. You know, we were formed in 1880 in Louisville, and we really were designed to help work on legislative and tax issues, and that really hasn't changed to this day. So we've been around a while. We like to talk about all sorts of those key moments in history, whether it's the Bottled and Bond Act, which you really start digging into that, is really the first consumer protection legislation by Congress that's really started around whiskey, but really kind of laid the framework for other consumer protection. So people really knew what they were drinking, down to, you know, a bourbon being designated and protected as indigenous to the United States, just like champagne or tequila. in other countries like France and Mexico. And so now bourbon's considered America's spirit. So all those points on the timeline are a big part of our story. And I think our distilleries do a good job, you know, talking about how they fit into that. I think it's part of the marketing too. You'll see a little bit some of the old pictures and some of the advertising. Is just so fascinating when you look back at old Four Roses or other Brown-Forman products. It's just fascinating to see some of the history involved in that. And I think the biggest change too that we're working on is really trying to live up to what we're seeing in today's day and age with, you know, how is race depicted and how is diversity depicted, and what are other voices that really help make bourbon what it is today that maybe are underrepresented or are not known as well. So that's been a big initiative of ours at the KDA, of really trying to dig more into that history. We've been working with a lot of different groups to help inform the public in a better way, because we can always do a better job of talking about those underrepresented voices that really added to Kentucky bourbon as we know it. And maybe people just don't know as much about some of the labor and some of the key people.
Dealing with the diversity and inclusion angle and sort of those underrepresented people, for example, do you have any stories off the top of your head that pertain to, you know, that subject?
Well, we're still really digging into that. I think like the folks out at Locust Grove in Louisville, we've been working with Andrea Merriweather on some of the programming on that, and digging into what was the slave population, what did they add to Kentucky bourbon's process. I think you've seen that also in Tennessee with Nearest Green and Jack Daniels, and how Brown-Forman has been working with the Uncle Nearest brand to try to tell that story. But it's complicated. And so I think we're trying to really shine a light on what people may not know went into the process of our those early days of distillation. So I think those are the stories that we're really trying to dig into a little bit more. And that's been a fun part of the job.
So you obviously know a lot about the history of bourbon, and you've dug into that in recent years. And what do you think future historians will be studying about the bourbon industry? And what do you think they'll learn about the industry today?
Ooh, that's a good one. I think one thing that would be interesting is to see how much the international market has really helped the growth of Kentucky bourbon. We've just seen such exponential growth overseas. The current tariffs have not helped us much. So hopefully we can get that figured out soon, because as my boss says, there are no winners in a trade war.
Right.
But, you know, over the last couple of years, just, you know, big picture, the international aspect of bourbon, I don't think can be underestimated. And then I would love to see how bourbon does in the cyclical nature of how these things go in our industry, right? There was a time when bourbon was king, and then it was not, and we really suffered, you know, in the 60s, 70s, you know, early 80s. And now, you know, we've just seen this huge rise. You know, can we keep that? I've always heard said, you know, people didn't want to drink what their parents or grandparents were drinking. And, you know, will that be the case in 10, 20 years? Will bourbon still be here? I think it will, because of the international market, number one. Two, I think just the authenticity of it will always last. This is a very hard product to make, all natural. And I think it fits kind of the time we're living in. That's something, you know, 40, 50 years from now, I would love to know, when historians start digging into this time period, what they're able to glean. And I'll be reading right there with them.
So for years, I've tried to pin you down. What is your favorite bourbon brand?
Ooh, yeah. Number one question I get, easiest right. question for me to avoid. And because and people tend to not believe me, but it really just depends on what's going on. Am I having a cocktail? What time of year? I mean, today it is, it really feels like fall today for the first time. Man, wouldn't it be nice to have something a little higher proof, you know, sitting outside by the fire or something, versus what, 2 days ago, as you know, in Kentucky, our weather changes. You know, I'm thinking like a nice highball or something iced down pretty good when it's a little warmer. So yeah, hard for me to answer. Working with all these guys, there's a brand that I love in each of them. And that's the beauty of the job, is we've been exposed to so many different spirits that our guys make. It's hard to really pick just one.
Well, I failed again in pinning you down on that, but I'll accept your answer. But Adam, thanks so much for being here. And again, yeah. I've been speaking with Adam Johnson, Senior Director of the Kentucky Bourbon Trail. And Adam, where can people find the trail online?
You can go to kybourbontrail.com. You can go to kybourbon.com for more general stuff. Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, you can find us everywhere.
Bourbon everywhere. And Adam, thanks for being here.
Yes, sir.
Definitely, bourbon tourism has really invigorated the industry, and we're finding out new things every day by looking to the past and the history of bourbon. And in fact, since it opened to tourists in 2017, there's an exhibit called the Bourbon Pompeii attraction at Buffalo Trace Distillery in Frankfort. It has sparked an interest in the long and sometimes hidden history of Kentucky's signature spirit, and that's music to the ears of bourbon archaeologist Nick Laraquente, who helped excavate the site. Bourbon Pompeii refers to the remnants of Colonel Taylor's OFC distillery, which dates all the way back to at least 1873. And because of these and other recent finds, Laraquente has become a popular presenter on the public speaking circuit. That was before COVID, of course. In fact, in May 2019, I caught up with him after one of his presentations, and we talked about Bourbon Pompeii and a lot of other things.
I mean, there's definitely not a shortage of old abandoned distilleries or people that want me to come out and look at them. So,
yeah, and you, in your presentation, you talked about several different ones. Of course, Bourbon Pompeii is the one that sucks up all the headlines. But there are some other projects that you've been working on.
Yeah, most of it's been associated with the Jack Jewett Historic Site in Woodford County. And we've been looking at an old 1790 distillery that was run by Jack Jewett, a Revolutionary War hero. But we've also looked at smaller farm distilleries also around Woodford County. One of my next projects coming up is we're going to start working with the Rippey family next door in Lawrenceburg. And they're restoring the Rippey family home. And we're going to start looking at other distilleries that were associated with their family members. And that'll be maybe this summer sometime.
Is there a personal story that sort of got you into to becoming a bourbon archaeologist?
Well, my first experience with the bourbon industry, because I really didn't think that much of it for a little while, was probably 2008 or so. I was driving through Millville. I was on my way to Frankfort, and it was a very foggy day, and I just stumbled across what is now Castle and Key Distillery. But it looked like something out of Silent Hill or a horror film. It was all foggy. I was like, what is this thing, you know? And I started digging a little deeper into it, realizing that all these distilleries are everywhere, abandoned distilleries just off the beaten path. And then I realized that nobody was looking at them. So the way that I really got into it was I was looking for a dissertation topic, and I wanted to do something in Kentucky. I'm from here, my family's from here, and I was like, there's not enough archaeology being done on sites. Nobody's looking at this, so I'll just dedicate my career to distilleries.
And you know, you got a really good question there at the end of your presentation. It was basically, how does bourbon archaeology feed into like the tourism boom now that we're seeing with these distilleries?
I think it's all tied with authenticity, right? People, they come to do the bourbon trail and go to places like Buffalo Trace Distillery because they want to know authentic stories, authentic histories. People that are really into bourbon aren't really into smoke and mirrors. And I think it's where bourbon archaeology and the interest of the larger industry kind of connect, because we can verify stories. We can find artifacts that are directly tied to those histories. And when you get to hold like a piece of that copper sheeting for Bourbon Pompeii in your hand, you know, it's like it's a connection that you can't really get any other way. So I think that's the thing I really like about it.
All right, I do have to ask about Bourbon Pompeii, yeah, because, you know, a lot of people do. And and I'm sure it was just like one of those great eureka moments when you first cast your eyes on that.
Oh, yeah. Like, I went down there with Meredith Moody and Dennis Walsh. They were the people that were really in charge of the project. And I was just freaking out because, as an archaeologist, I was seeing all of these different colors of soil. It was almost like a layer cake you'd pick up from Kroger or something like that, right? And that's archaeology 101, because you can start at the icing, and that's the present. And the deeper you go into the cake, the farther you're going into the past. And so when I saw the layers, I was like, this is great. I don't know what it is yet, but there's something intact here. And that's whenever they gave me that weekend, and it was the best weekend of my life. It was like 20 hours down in the pit, just me and the artifacts and the dirt, and they lowered sandwiches down to me every now and then to feed me, and it led to what it is today. It's incredible.
Yeah, and they have taken what your work and have really created something that it's a window into the past, but it's also, it kind of speaks to why bourbon is so important in this state.
Right. I mean, here in 8 years or so, whenever you can taste what they've recreated out of what Taylor was doing at the OFC distillery, there's going to be so many layers. I mean, sure, you're going to have what you're tasting in the cup, but you're also going to have the stories. You can be like, all right, look at all these layers of archaeology that was done. Look at the time that they put into reconstructing this in a very authentic way that still meets modern safety standards. Look at all the tourism buzz around this. There's going to be I can't wait for 8 years from now to be able to taste that stuff.
You are also talking about kind of the opportunity maybe for moonshine stills and archaeology in that area.
Oh, yeah. So, there's so much across Kentucky. Like, I focused on Daniel Boone National Forest because that's one of the places that is more or less protected, preserved in place. And they have nearly 300 moonshine sites just throughout the forest. Some of these places have been literally loved to death. The Hanging Bucket site that I talked about, a lot of rock climbers go in that area and they think they're helping by removing trash from an area, right? But what ended up happening there is all the artifacts that were described from 1980s are now gone. So one of the things I'm really interested in is working with them, trying to develop more of a like a context to figure out what's important about these sites and how to protect them, but also capture those stories, because I think there's a lot there that we could still build on.
And somebody did ask you about if you suspect that you, on your property, if you're a property owner, that you might have something like a bourbon, an old distillery, you know, the remnants thereof. What's the advice? What's the best way to preserve it? Obviously, to contact you first, but then what?
But also, like, sketch a map of the site. Not everybody really likes doing that. I mean, you can print out, like, a Google Earth image of your property and sketch, like, this is where things are, what I think this building is. Maybe there's old warehouse remnants over in this other area. But also just, preserve it in place. You don't want to dig up all the artifacts and take it home and forget exactly where you found them from, because say you dig up bits of a copper still and you forget where you got it at, is you're going to have a hard time relocating that still later on when you want to like do a more serious research of that area.
My thanks to Nick Laraquinte talking about Bourbon Pompeii, the attraction at Buffalo Trace Distillery, and his role in uncovering that. And you talk about uncovering things about the bourbon industry. Greg, you have a story that goes way, way back before the OFC distillery, one of the earliest recipes, as a matter of fact, for bourbon.
Yeah, and it was something that actually was hinted at in Stuart's interview as well. This is a recipe that is probably one of the oldest bourbon recipes that we have in our collection, and it's from Casey County, from 1818, but there's some historical questions about it, whether or not it was actually written by the woman that is credited. And some of our staff, Sherry Daniels and Dina Thomas, both archivists here at the Kentucky Historical Society, did some extensive research and have uncovered what they think is the truth behind these documents.
From an article published in the August 2019 edition of Kentucky Ancestors, written by Sherry Daniels and Dina Thomas.
In 1995, the Carpenter family papers were donated to the Kentucky Historical Society. The scope of the collection runs from 1788 to 1928 and includes documents from several members of this family as well as their acquaintances. In 1806, this mother of 12 children was widowed for the second time and left to run the large family farm in Casey County, which she did quite successfully. In fact, she was very hands-on and dedicated to making this endeavor succeed as a legacy for her family. Within the documents from Catherine's lifespan was found a handwritten double recipe for distilling spirits. One side of the document includes a recipe for sour mash whiskey, and on the other side, a recipe for sweet mash whiskey. The document also includes a secondary note at the bottom, written in different colored ink, attributing the recipe to 1818. There is no mention of authorship. Despite a lack of attribution, a family narrative developed, claiming these to be Catherine Carpenter's mash recipes. Did Catherine create these recipes, use these recipes, or were they shared recipes among the family and community?
To a 100-gallon tub, put in a bushel and a half of hot water, then a half bushel of meal. Stir it well. Then one bushel of water, and then a half bushel of meal, and so on, until you have mashed one bushel and a half of cornmeal. Stir it all effectively, then sprinkle a double handful of meal over the mash. Let it stand 2 hours, then pour over the mash 2 gallons of warm water. Put in a half gallon of malt, stir that well, into the mash, then stir in a half bushel of rye or wheat meal. Stir it well. In 15 minutes, put in another half gallon of malt. Stir it well, and very frequently, until you can bear your hand in the mash up to your wrist. Then put in 3 bushels of cold slop or 1 gallon of good yeast. Then fill up with cold water. If you use yeast, put in the cold water first and then the yeast. If you have neither yeast nor slop, put in 3 peck of beer from the bottom of a tub.
Catherine Spears was born in Virginia about 1760 to German immigrants. Sometime prior to 1780, Catherine married fellow Virginian John Fry. In 1780, the couple traveled west into the new Kentucky Territory. The group settled in the newly formed Lincoln County, Kentucky, at a place they named Carpenter Station. The land included in Carpenter Station is near present-day Houstonville along Carpenter's Creek. Within the collections of the Kentucky Historical Society are documents indicating that Catherine was a successful woman of business, with one problem. Catherine Carpenter could not read or write. Several of her legal transactions, and even her own will of 1848, are marked with an X, given in the place of her signature. This indicates that she could not write her name. Further evidence from the 1840 federal census lists Catherine as the only free white person in the household, with an accompanying hash mark in the column, quote, could not read or write. Did Catherine Carpenter personally write these sour and sweet mash whiskey recipes? No. It is safe to say that she did not personally write them down. Did she create these recipes? That is very possible. But other recipes in her collection came from male members of the nearby Carpenter family. Also, the guardian of Catherine's children, William Crow, had a license to distill whiskey in nearby Lincoln County in 1814, which was 4 years before the recipes were put down onto paper. Despite her literacy limitations, Catherine more than likely used these recipes to instruct her household members, including the 19-plus enslaved workers who had a significant hand in making the farm a financial success, how to distill a proper batch of whiskey. As many family stories contain some threads of truth, we're still confident in calling this Catherine Carpenter's sour and sweet mash whiskey recipe, circa 1818 to 1848.
Well, that was really great. I really appreciate all the research that Dina and Sherry did at the Kentucky Historical Society to really bring us that story. And one thing that I found really interesting is how that connects to my interview with Adam Johnson at the Kentucky Bourbon Trail, because they talked about the 19 enslaved workers that were, you know, directed by the Carpenter family to make that whiskey. And so that ties into what Adam was talking about in terms of how they're trying to, you know, find more underrepresented voices and bring those to the forefront. And I think, you know, this shows how research can be done to do that. I really found that compelling.
Yeah, family history. We're talking about, new things being uncovered all the time in this signature industry, and honoring the past as well. As a matter of fact, Stuart, you mentioned the Kentucky Distillers Association. They created this thing called the Kentucky Bourbon Hall of Fame back in 2001, and it was to recognize individuals and organizations that have made a significant impact on bourbon stature, growth, and awareness. It's the highest honor given by the signature industry, and of course now because of the COVID-19 pandemic, the KDA made the decision to cancel this year's induction ceremony. So Today, I'm serving up a special profile of a 2018 inductee, Buffalo Trace Distillery's Freddie Johnson. So what is so special about Freddie? Well, I would just invite you all to listen and learn. Colonel Taylor, George T. Stagg, Pappy Van Winkle, Albert B. Blanton, Elmer T. Lee, all names synonymous with these hallowed grounds. And this man makes sure you know about them all.
I do have bourbon in my blood.
Hey, 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 Sydney, how you doing? Take care of him, Carol. All right.
Are you like the mayor around here?
Kentucky native Freddie Johnson was born in where else but Bourbon County. He serves as an unofficial brand ambassador of sorts, and he's a third-generation employee at Buffalo Trace. His grandfather worked alongside Colonel Blanton. His dad, Jimmy, was a friend and co-worker of Elmer T. Lee's. So who better to give me a guided tour of this massive operation?
Right now we're sitting on a little over 400 acres of land. But the way it sits back in here, you'd never know it. They deliberately go about trying to make everything blend in. So if you notice all the buildings and stuff, the design, even the new distribution center, designed just like the old warehouses, so everything kind of like fits together.
Sprinkled in amongst his artful explanations and demonstrations of how bourbon is distilled, barreled, and bottled, this master storyteller throws in more than a pinch of history.
The distillery itself goes back to the 1700s. It is the original trace or trail of the buffalo through Kentucky. They swam across the river right behind this distillery. They would walk four or five abreast of each other, and they cleared out pathways that were 75 to 100 feet wide.
Hence the name Buffalo Trace. But Johnson is quick to point out the bourbon business has seen its share of ups and downs, and the current boom is a more recent phenomenon.
We found an old postcard, and at one point, the security guard was the tour guide. And he had his uniform and stuff on, and he would walk you around a little bit, but very limited exposure to the inner workings of filling the barrels with, filling the bottles with whiskey, or filling the barrels with whiskey. But you got a chance to at least walk around and see some of this stuff.
Good morning. Are you here for tour? Can I just the two of you?
Now a steady stream of visitors line up almost every day for what's billed as a bourbon experience.
So they get a chance to actually interact with the folks on the line, chat with them a little bit, and what happens is you get an emotional connection. So they begin to realize these are folks just like me. I see the whiskey going into the barrel. I see how it's being aged. I see the people that actually handle it.
As we cover but a fraction of the sprawling campus, sometimes on foot, sometimes in a golf cart, Freddie tells me more about his life story. How his career path took him to New York to work for AT&T, the bittersweet day he came back to Frankfurt to take care of his ailing father and brother, and how that decision led to his return to Buffalo Trace. We suddenly stop in front of a tiny warehouse that holds one and only one special barrel.
That is the 6 millionth barrel to have come through this distillery since Prohibition. The honor that my family has. My dad, at 94 years old, had become the only living person to personally handle every millionth barrel that's ever come through this little building since Prohibition.
As our journey together nears its end, Freddie reminds me of two universal truths. Courtesy costs nothing but counts for everything, and you never get a second chance to make a first impression.
We want everybody to know that we're glad you came to Buffalo Trace. We know that you could have gone somewhere else. But the objective for us is that while you are here, let's talk about what we're doing and let's share things with each other and let's see if we can make you feel good about the time you spent.
So. Oh, I know I have.
Public relations and events manager Amy Preske says Freddie Johnson is the heart and soul of Buffalo Trace.
You cannot replace Freddie. I mean, you can go on any Yelp review or TripAdvisor and everyone says, ask for Freddie, ask for Freddie, ask for Freddie. Yesterday I saw a hashtag on a Google review that said, hashtag ask for Freddie.
And I got him.
You did.
And I am happy to report that Freddie was indeed on hand when Buffalo Trace poured its 7 millionth barrel since the end of Prohibition. And of course, they are well on their way to filling their 8 millionth. The 7 millionth was filled on April 23rd, 2018, and Freddie and his nephew Osiris were certainly in attendance. As a matter of fact, they were the guests of honor. Special thanks to Amy Preske, Meredith Moody, and all the folks at Buffalo Trace Distillery in Frankfort for helping me tell this story.
So, guys, we have talked about the history of bourbon quite a bit today, but we haven't talked about the best part, the flavor, the taste, the enjoying of the bourbon. As I said at the beginning, bourbon.
So, sipping and the savoring, correct?
Sipping and the savoring, yeah. So, you know, as we produce this podcast, we each produce our different segments. But to close out today, I really wanted to do something different. So I've got a letter written March 30th, 1937, by Simon Bolivar Buckner, Jr. And he's writing to his friend, General William D. Connor at West Point in New York. Can I read it to you guys out loud?
Please. Absolutely.
Okay, so it begins this way. My dear General Connors, your letter requesting my formula for mixing mint julep leaves me in the same position in which Captain Barber found himself when asked how he was able to carve the image of an elephant from a block of wood. He replied that it was a simple process, consisting merely of whittling off the part that didn't look like an elephant. The preparation of the quintessence of gentlemanly beverages can be described only in like terms. A mint julep is not the product of a formula. It is a ceremony and must be performed by a gentleman possessing a true sense of the artistic, a deep reverence for the ingredients, and a proper appreciation of the occasion. It is a rite that must not be entrusted to the novice, a statistician, nor a Yankee. Which I love that part there. It is a heritage of the Old South, an emblem of hospitality, and a vehicle in which noble minds can travel together upon the flavor-strewn paths of happy and congenial thought. Who writes like this? Nobody writes like this nowadays.
Certainly not anymore. No.
Not anymore. And it continues. And this is where it starts to get into the dripping description here. So far as the mere mechanics of the operations are concerned, the procedure, stripped of its ceremonial embellishments, can be described as follows. Go to a spring where cool, crystal clear water bubbles from under a bank of dew-washed ferns. In a consecrated vessel, dip up a little water at the source. Follow the streams through its banks of green moss and wildflowers until it broadens and trickles through beds of mint growing in aromatic profusion and waving softly in the summer breeze. Gather the sweetest and tenderest shoots and gently carry them home. Go to the sideboard and select a decanter of Kentucky bourbon, distilled by a master hand, mellowed with age, yet still vigorous and inspiring. An ancestral sugar bowl, a row of silver goblets, some spoons, and some ice, and you are ready to start. My mouth is watering, guys, already. I don't know what you guys. In a canvas bag, pound twice as much ice as you think you will need. Make it fine as snow. Keep it dry and do not allow it to degenerate into slush. In each goblet, put a slightly heaping teaspoon of granulated sugar. Barely cover this with spring water and slightly bruise one leaf into this, leaving the spoon in the goblet. Then pour elixir from the decanter until the goblets are about 1/4 full. Fill the goblets with snowy ice, sprinkling a small amount of sugar as you fill. Wipe the outside of the goblets dry and embellish copiously with mint. Then comes the important and delicate operation of frosting, Now, this is a procedure I've never heard described thus before, so listen to this, guys. By proper manipulation of the spoon, the ingredients are circulated and blended until nature, wishing to take a further hand and another of its beautiful phenomena, encrust the whole in a glistening coat of white frost. Thus, harmoniously blended by the deft touches of a skilled hand, you have a beverage eminently appropriate for honorable men and beautiful women. When all is ready, assemble your guests on the perch. Sorry.
Have you been trying mint juleps today, Greg?
I think I may have been dipping into one, yeah.
You tried the recipe.
It's bad typing. It's like kind of hard to read. Sorry.
It's a poor musician who blames his instrument.
Yes, right? Okay, fine. I'll take that. When all is ready, assemble your guests on the porch or in the garden, where the aroma of the juleps will rise heavenward and make the birds sing. Propose a worthy toast. Raise the goblet to your lips. Bury your nose in the mint. Inhale a deep breath of its fragrance and sip the nectar of the gods. Being overcome by thirst, I can write no further. Sincerely, Simon B. Buckner, Jr.
Oh, that's
yes,
great.
Yeah, because he probably climbed inside that bourbon bottle right after.
Right. I think I may have dipped into it a little bit, too, before reading this.
Yeah, I find it really interesting. Buckner was actually the son of Kentucky Governor Simon Bolivar Buckner, who was a former Confederate general and, you know, sort of saw himself as a very courtly knight. So I think a lot of that is reflected in his son's writing. And his son, actually, he was killed in 1945 at Okinawa during World War II and was the highest-ranking general to fall during that conflict. And so it's great that we have that recipe, you know, that piece of history that, you know, ties back to Kentucky history and traditions, and also, you know, is reflected in the Buckner family, too.
And it's yet one more connection. We began this podcast with a little bourbon history during World War II, and we end it with a little bourbon history during World War II.
Somehow. Well, he's thirsty.
I was going to say, somehow we have made it to the end, and we're all sort of bellying up to the bar in podcast fashion. You know, it's always great to uncover these great stories about things that make Kentucky Kentucky.
Yeah, and I think, you know, that's the goal of this podcast, you know, going from horses now to bourbon, and, you know, I'm looking forward to seeing what we explore next.
Make sure you follow us on all of our social media and tune in for the next podcast to come.
I would like to, and of course, when we're talking about people to thank, I want to first of all thank the president and CEO, Mark Brown, of Buffalo Trace Distillery, which is Sazerac, and also Amy Presky, Meredith Moody, and all the folks at Buffalo Trace for helping me tell their stories.
Yeah, and same here. I'm, you know, appreciative of Adam Johnson with the Kentucky Distillers Association for talking to me about the history and heritage tied to the Kentucky Bourbon Trail.
Special thanks to Keith Jackson, Sherry Daniels, and Dana Zinger for providing voiceovers, and to Sherry Daniels and Dina Thomas for their article on the Carpenter Family Bourbon Recipe.
Well, that puts a capper on our bourbon edition of 120 Common Threads of Kentucky History. I'm Alan Lytle, the news director at 91.3 WUKY. Special thanks also to Stuart and Greg from the Kentucky Historical Society, and we'll certainly see you next time.